We are all very aware that the church is under attack these days and always has been under attack throughout the history of the world. Christianity is opposed in many ways, and sometimes rightly so, just because of the way that people act who call themselves Christian. And so I don't have to outline for you all the ways in which we are attacked, but you know about things like the homosexual agenda, ISIS, and political correctness and so forth, that in various ways would attack the church of Jesus Christ in order to destroy it. As a church, we tend not to be humble about that, but to point our fingers at all these others instead of recognizing our own sinfulness. Now, certainly, there are times when God's people have been innocent and yet others come against them. What is the duty, though, that has been given to us? What is our responsibility as we respond to all these attacks, as we respond to seeing what is going on in the various nations of the world? Well, we have been called by God to be His people, to show forth His praises, show forth the praises of Him who has called us out of darkness into His marvelous light. We have been called to pray for the nations to know Him and to rejoice in Him, because He is indeed the Lord our God. And so He is to be worshipped and honored. But we also then have a responsibility towards the nations around us to be those who would be in prayer for them. And so what we're seeing today is that the church has been given a priesthood to carry out for the nations, as God has placed us here, so that we have an obligation to the nations in the way that we conduct our lives and in the things then that we do. And this comes out, I think, quite clearly in Daniel chapter 8. I'm going to read that now for our scripture lesson today. Daniel chapter 8. And a couple of things that perhaps we ought to note before actually reading this chapter. From the time that we came to chapter 2, verse 4, until the end of chapter 7, that was written in Aramaic. And so that was more of an international language. Beginning with chapter 8 on through the end of the book, it is written again in Hebrew, indicating that this is more directly for the people of God. And so that people of God really need to understand what their duty is as they face the nations. Now, he's still dealing with the nations. And as we look at the animals that come up here that are a part of this vision that Daniel has, these two in particular, there's the ram and the shaggy goat, that represent two of the nations that we saw way just back in the previous chapter, where there were four beasts that came up out of the sea. And these two animals, the ram and the shaggy goat, are going to correspond to the second and third beasts that we read about in chapter 7. So you see, this is not something that is completely separate. And in fact, I want you to notice that when we read the first verse, he says, "I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me." Why does he say that last part? I mean, we know that the first one appeared in the first year of Belshazzar's reign, and this one, he says, appeared in the third year of Belshazzar's reign. So we know it was after the one that had already appeared to him. Why does he waste words there? Well, it's in order to connect us back to that there is a connection between these two. And so with these things in mind, we could probably point out other things at this point, but let's move ahead to read God's word, beginning with chapter 8, verse 1, on through the end of the chapter. "In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw myself in the city of Susa, in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later. I watched the ram as he charged towards the west and the north and the south. No animal could stand against him, and no one could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between his eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. He came toward the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and charged him in great rage. I saw him attack the ram furiously, striking the ram and shattering his two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against him. The goat knocked him to the ground and trampled on him, and none could rescue the ram from his power. The goat became very great, but at the height of his power, his large horn was broken off. And in its place, four prominent horns grew up towards the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east, toward the beautiful land. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, "How long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, and the surrender of the sanctuary and of the host that will be trampled underfoot." He said to me, "It will take 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated." While I, Daniel, was watching the vision and trying to understand it, there before me stood one who looked like a man, and I heard a man's voice from the Ulai calling, "Gabriel, tell this man the meaning of the vision." As he came near the place where I was standing, I was terrified and fell prostrate. "Son of man," he said to me, "understand that the vision concerns the time of the end." While he was speaking to me, I was in deep sleep with my face to the ground. Then he touched me and raised me to my feet. He said, "I'm going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. The two-horned ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat is the king of Greece, and the large horn between his eyes is the first king. The four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his nation but will not have the same power. In the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a stern-faced king, a master of intrigue, will arise. He will become very strong, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy the mighty man and the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper and will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the prince of princes. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. The vision of the evenings and mornings that has been given to you is true. But seal up the vision, for it concerns the distant future." I, Daniel, was exhausted and lay ill for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled by the vision, It was beyond understanding. May God bless to us the reading of this portion of His Word, so that we may understand it and know how to deal with it in our lives day by day. I want to remind you of the Israelites when they came out of Egypt. Remember that they had been in Egypt. When they were in Egypt, they were slaves. And when they came out of Egypt, there were a number of things that happened by which God showed them marvelous grace. There were those 10 plagues that afflicted the Egyptians. And then He brought Israel out and provided for them as they would knock on their neighbor's door and say, "We need gold and silver," and they would readily give it. They came to the Red Sea and they saw Pharaoh's army coming after them, and God opened up the Red Sea so that they could go through on dry land. They came into that Sinai Peninsula, and they were there without water, and they came to a place where there was water and it was bitter. And so a tree was thrown in. Perhaps it was a piece of wood, but some translations have it as a tree. God provided water for them. In the next chapter, we have them have God providing manna for His people, so they have something to eat. In the next chapter, here come the Amalekites against them. Now, they didn't have to fight the Egyptians. They just had to get through the Red Sea in time for the sea to be closed over the Egyptian army. But they had to fight against the Amalekites. And as Moses' hands were raised and being held up by Aaron and Hur, Israel prospered and defeated the Amalekites. And then right after that, at the end of chapter 17, you have them bringing water out of the rock. And in chapter 18 of Exodus, you find that God is using Moses' father-in-law to help them to set things up so that he will not be destroyed, so that Moses will not be destroyed by being wearied by the people coming to him all day. They are being set up now as a nation, and they have come to Mount Sinai, where they will be given the law of God. But as they are there in chapter 19 of Exodus, and they're preparing to receive the law of God, God says to them, "You are a chosen people. You are to be a kingdom of priests." Excuse me. There was the duty that God gave them. They were to be a kingdom of priests, so that as they faced the nations, they would be those through whom the magnificence of God would become known. He had said to them there, "Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." They were to pray for the world. They were to be that kind of a nation, so that they were to pray for the world just as Job prayed for his children. Do you remember that in the first chapter of Job? How Job would make burnt offerings to the Lord. "Perhaps my children have sinned." And so he interceded for them. And that's what Israel was to be doing for the nations. And as they lived there and the nations came through, they were to see what it was like to live under the lordship of the Lord God. And they were to show to the nations who God is, as well as to pray for them. Those were the duties of the priest, the duties of the priesthood that was given to them. But what did they do? They asked that Samuel would give them a king so that they could be like the nations around them. Not the treasured possession that God had made them to be, but to be like the nations. Instead of being who God wanted them to be, they wanted to be like the nations. And when they conquered the land of Canaan, what did they do with the gods of Canaan? They worshiped them. Here they defeated these kings. They defeated these nations. And then they took their gods. How foolish. The gods that had not been able to protect the people of the land of Canaan. And in the case of one of the kings of Judah, we find him defeating someone to the north. And he sees an altar there that is used in the worship of a false god. And he has somebody write down the construction of that altar and send it back to Jerusalem so that the high priest can have an altar like it made. And that would replace the altar that God had established there. So that they were changing the worship that God had appointed for them. Israel's duty was to be a kingdom of priests, but you see, instead they tried to be like the nations around them. Not one who was different, not one who was showing forth the praises of Him who has called us out of darkness into the light of the gospel. Well, what was the duty of the nations while this was going on? Their duty was to, first of all, Israel is sent into exile. And the nations then were really to be those protectors of God's people so that they would be preserved for the glory of God. But of course, they didn't look at it that way. As they are taken into exile, we find Nebuchadnezzar, who first of all rebelled and then protected them. Remember, he was the one that appointed for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be thrown into the furnace. And then he realizes, wow, their God is amazing. Their God is awesome. And so on through that book, you find a number of things in regard to Nebuchadnezzar. But then you come to Belshazzar, the next king that really addresses issues here in Daniel's prophecy. And Belshazzar knows who Daniel is. I mean, he's grown up there. He's heard about the things that have taken place. Now, when you come to chapter 5 of Daniel, and you have, remember the handwriting on the wall? That's where Belshazzar's the king. Okay. His mother comes in and says, now, there's this guy Daniel who did all this for Nebuchadnezzar, and you've forgotten him. Instead, here you are taking the vessels from the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and you're flaunting them. You're exercising your authority over that God. Part of this is what Daniel points out to him. And so, Belshazzar's mother says, now wait, you need to know that what this guy Daniel has done. He can read that writing on the wall. He can tell you what it means. And so he's called in and set before him. And he deals with him there. You see, Belshazzar knew who Daniel was, but he rejected him. Did you notice what it says in the last verse of the chapter? I, Daniel, was exhausted and lay ill for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. What king? Belshazzar. He's the only king around here. Daniel is in service of the king. And this is prior to the handwriting on the wall. You see how Belshazzar has known about Daniel and he's known about Daniel's God, but he has totally rejected him. Forget about him. I don't like him. In Darius, then later on, we find him being able to, or to be persuaded to write up that foolish law that no one should make request of any man or God except of the king for 30 days. And because of that, he has to order Daniel to be thrown into the den of lions. And the next morning, he brings him out. And he seems to be one who, if not converted, at least becomes very favorable towards God's people. In fact, this may be the very person who is also called Cyrus. Darius and Cyrus, some people think it's the same person. And remember that Isaiah had prophesied that Cyrus would be the one who would be used to send the people back to the land of Israel. Okay, these are the things that are going on for people who were supposed to be preserving God's covenant people. That's why he had put them there. We find in the days of Ahasuerus that Haman tries to destroy the people of God, but God does preserve them through Esther. And so now Daniel is given this vision, the one that we have read here in chapter 8. And remember, it's connected to the first one where you had four beasts that come up out of the ocean, out of the waters. The first one being the lion, the second one the bear, the third one the leopard or the panther, and then the fourth one is nondescript. It is so horrifying. This first vision represented these kings, these kingdoms, as having kingly glory. Now, the lion, the king of the beasts. The bear, a very powerful, along with the panther and so forth, a very powerful kingly authority. But did you notice what kind of animals are used in the second vision? These are domesticated animals, but not just domesticated animals. He doesn't give them camels and donkeys or horses or cats and dogs, but he gives them... He shows a vision with the ram and the sheep, or the goat, I mean. These were sacrificial animals. So whereas in the previous vision you're dealing with the kingly authority, here you're dealing with a priestly responsibility. You see how that change has taken place. And so beasts 2 and 3 of the first vision are beasts 1 and 2 of the second vision. Priestly sacrificial animals. And one of the things we read about each of these is that they magnify themselves. They set themselves up. They make themselves great. And there's a word in the Hebrew that recurs a number of times here where the ram makes himself great. The goat makes himself great. And it's very clear who these two are. The Medes and the Persians. In fact, Gabriel makes that very clear to Daniel. The Medes and the Persians would be the ram. And so there's those two horns. One that is longer than the other. And it's a picture that seems to me to be contrary to nature, because the ram's horn, remember, is one that just kind of curls around here. But it talks about it being longer than the other. Well, it could be, I guess, a longer curl. But at any rate, the one horn is greater than the other because the Persians were greater than the Medes. And it talks about them going north, south, and west. They were already in the east. So they don't have to conquer that direction. They conquer north, west, and south. And normally, up to this point, the west has been where Israel is. But now we hear of one who is in the west. And that's the shaggy goat that comes from the west. And he comes as if he's flying over the ground. He is that rapid. And of course, it's the kingdom of Greece. And there's one horn that represents the first of the kings. And most of you probably already know who that is, Alexander the Great. And he crushes the horns of the ram, and the ram cannot stand against him. And so here's this goat that is exalting himself, magnifying himself, making himself great. And then we read of the four kingdoms that arise from that. The question is, do they arise together? Or do they rise successively? Most people have thought of them as rising four kingdoms, as Alexander's generals are given various kingdoms, but apparently there were more, and I'm not a great man of history, but I've read from James Jordan that there were a number of kingdoms, actually more than four, that arose out of the Grecian kingdom. And so he tends to think of this as successive kingdoms that come until you come to a little horn that arises. And guess what it says about the little horn? He makes himself great. You see the pride that is involved in this, the arrogance, as the little horn makes himself great, and as each of these has made themselves great. And these are kingdoms then that continue toward the destruction of Jerusalem. They continue from this time all the way to the destruction of Jerusalem. So that when we have read here about the time of the end, it seems that this is a reference to 70 AD. That's the end that it's talking about. Not something that lies in the future for you and me, but something that would lay in the future for the Jews in particular, and that God would bring something to an end. And among these kingdoms that continue all the way to the destruction of Jerusalem is the little horn. Now, the identity of the little horn is important. Now, I realize that this is stuff that many of you are hearing for the first time, and it's not necessarily easy to follow. I hope it becomes clear to you, because I found this to be very, very helpful and useful. Who's the little horn? And the typical answer is Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes. And James Jordan has cogently argued that this is not the case. That rather that what it's dealing with for this little horn is what comes to be the rulers known as the Herods. Herod the Great, Herod Antipas, Herod Agrippa, and so forth. And who was with the Herods among the Jews? Well, it was the priests who labored with them. The Herods and the priests got along pretty well together. When we read about the destruction of the continuing offering. Now, first of all, that offering, what we're referring to there is the offering, remember, that was to be offered morning and evening on the burnt offering, altar of burnt offering. Daily, one offering in the morning, one in the evening. It was doubled on the Sabbath. But he would bring an end to it. One who is like Antiochus really can't bring an end to it without the cooperation of the priests. But Herod already had the cooperation of the priests. And so it seems that these are already being in cooperation with him, are the ones who bring an end to that offering. Herod the Great was the one who asked, who called for the destruction of those two and under in Bethlehem. Herod Antipas would have been in authority at the time of Christ's death. Herod Agrippa is one who is taken out, but not by human power. Remember what's mentioned here? He's one who would be taken out, but not by human power. And that's given to us in Acts chapter 13. He goes to a place where they're trying to get in his favor. And they start chanting, "The voice of a God and not of a man. The voice of a God and not of a man." And so he just revels in that. Isn't that wonderful? Instead of denying the place that is not his. Instead of denying that that place is his, he just eats it up, soaks it up. And he dies a few days later, and he is eaten by worms. Not by human hand. Now that takes place about 44 AD. Now you might recall that Herod's temple has been in construction. At the time of Jesus, remember how the Jews say to him, after he said, "Destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up." Oh, come on, this has been going on for 46 years. It was not complete. It was not complete when they said that. It was still going on. But it was completed about 64 AD. And in 64 AD, when it was completed, the Jews thought, "Well, look here. This proves how we are in God's favor. Everything is wonderful." And so they stepped up their persecution of Christians to say, "Look, we have God's favor. We are the chosen people. And this Apostle Paul, forget about him. He's wrong. Let's destroy him. Let's destroy the Christians." Now that's in 64 AD. 6 years later is 70 AD when the temple is destroyed. 365 days in a year, right? 365 times 6 is 2,190. You did that in your head, right? 2,190. 2,190 from 2,300 is 110, or about, you know, very roughly a third of a year. 6 years and a little more, and the sanctuary is destroyed. That's where that 2,300 apparently comes in. The destruction of Jerusalem. And the sanctuary is renewed. Now, if the temple is destroyed, how is the sanctuary renewed? Well, it's because it is the true sanctuary that God's people, the Christians, are worshiping in. It's where you and I are right now. And I'm not talking about this building. I'm talking about where we are before the throne of God right now. That sanctuary has been renewed. And so God's people enter in there to worship Him. This may be a little difficult to follow, but I trust it has helped you to see what Daniel is talking about, or what God is really dealing with in this vision. And now we read in 1 Peter chapter 2, coming back to where we started. 1 Peter chapter 2, and the 9th and 10th verses. "But you are a chosen people." He's writing to God, to Christians now. "You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation." Sounds like Exodus 19, doesn't it? Verse 5. "You are a royal priesthood, a people belonging to God, that you may declare His praises." the praises of Him who called you out of darkness into His wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. The duty that God gave to Israel when He brought them out of Egypt is a duty that He has given to us. A royal priesthood. And in gratitude for the grace that God has shown to us, we are to be those who are compelled to show His praises. We reject the things that Israel went for. We don't want to be like the kings of the world. We have King Jesus and we serve Him. That doesn't mean we are not subject to kings on earth, but rather we recognize that the Lord our God is the one who receives our highest allegiance. We do not go after the idols of the nations that have been conquered. And so we don't go after the ways of the world because those are idols as well. But we serve the one living and true God. And we don't choose the world's way to worship, but we worship as God has appointed in His Word. We are to present, you see, a contrast before the world, a contrast to what they are saying and what they are doing and what God has called us to be, as He's called us to be a kingdom of priests. And we are to intercede for the world. I wonder how often that 1 Timothy 2:1 really enters into the minds of God's people. Because there we are commanded to pray for those who are in authority. The things you have heard from me... That's 2 Timothy. 1 Timothy 2, I urge them, first of all, that requests, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgiving be made for everyone. For kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. There's the intercession that we are to be involved in. And when Jesus cleansed the temple, he had some very stern things to say. In Mark 11, for example, we have the cleansing of the temple. And He said, He taught them, is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations? It's not just a house of prayer, but it's a house of prayer for all nations. That the nations should come to know Him. We are to be now that can be taken in two senses. One, that we pray for the nations, but also that the nations are brought in. But both are very appropriate for us. And of course, there He is quoting from Isaiah chapter 56, the 7th verse. My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, because we are a royal priesthood, that we should show forth the praises of Him who called us out of darkness into His marvelous light. When God's people honor Him, He provides leaders to protect His own people. But if the house of prayer is neglected, we do so to our own detriment. We should not expect His blessing. But here we are as a kingdom of priests who are compelled by His grace to show forth His praises. We have been given a priesthood to carry out for the nations.